Joining the program now is Frank McGurk. Welcome.
Thank you, Luke. Glad to be here.
Well, I have you here because there's a new show this first Friday at the Carbondale Clay Center, and it's called Food, Drink, Flower, and you are one of the featured artists.
Yes, there are two of us, myself and Fumiko Nagai is joining me, so it's a two-person show, and we're very excited about it. We've been planning it for quite some time.
Now, are these functional pieces or sculptural?
Yes, actually the name, which we can talk about if you like, is Food, Drink, Flower. So we're making pots for food, serving food, eating food, pots for drinking, tea, sake, whiskey, anything that's liquid for the drinking part, and also functional pots for flowers, so flower displays, flower arrangements, and we'll have all of that, all of those kinds of works, Fumiko and I each doing some of each of those types of pieces for this show.
So mostly functional, not sculptural.
Exactly.
Oh, okay.
Some may have some sort of sculptural look, but they still have function.
What constitutes a sculptural look in
soil? Well, I think some of the pieces I'm making, for example, are kind of carved out of their heavy thrown works, and then I take a broad knife or a wooden knife and carve big chunks and pieces out to make a look that's not quite as uniform as what a lot of utilitarian work has.
Are you using a wheel?
Yes, mainly I use a wheel. Uh-huh. I make some hand-built pieces from slabs primarily.
And I read that Fumiko uses a Japanese-style kick wheel. What does that mean?
Well, it means it doesn't have a motor.
Okay.
That's first. And it's a very different style than what we use here in the United States. We have kick wheels, but more and more people have gone to the electric wheel for most of the work in our country. But the kick wheel that Fumiko uses, all Japanese, they rotate. It's interesting. The wheel rotates in the opposite direction from the way we do it in the United States.
Oh, how about that?
And it has a very small foot area that's a cone-shaped, and just so it's not as big in diameter. Anyway, it works exactly the way they like it to be.
So it's kind of like a treadle on a sewing machine.
Yes, but your foot actually does the wheel itself.
Oh, it does.
The treadle has a pedal-like movement to drive the wheel.
This is
the foot driven directly.
And why is it in America that we dispensed, why did Americans dispense with kick wheels and go electric? Because they listened to Bob Dylan in the 1960s?
No, I think because we're Americans and technology and innovation of those kinds of things really comes into play. There are still a lot of traditional American potters who use a treadle wheel that you mentioned, and also will just do kick wheel work. And not so many, but there are a lot of very accomplished potters who are doing hand-built work and don't use the wheel at all. But,
Now, do you play around with hand-built work?
Yes.
Occasionally?
Yes. Yeah, I do. I enjoy that.
What are the differences?
Well, hand-built is where it just about includes anything that's not thrown on the wheel, although the wheel-thrown work is handmade, obviously, and it's you can alter and change, and so a lot of times you may roll out slabs or coils and form those into pieces that you'd like to have. So it gives a lot more flexibility in certain ways to do handmade work, where it's the clay can be rolled out on a table, sliced, and put back together in different shapes and forms.
Do you see the piece in a lump of clay before it comes to life on the wheel, or does it happen in progress?
It's a good question. I think what I see, and I think what I've been taught to do, is before you have a lump of clay, a ball of clay on the wheel head when you're ready to start, and you should know for sure what you're making before you start turning the wheel. And so in that respect, you have a vision of what it is you're going to make. Is it going to be a vase form or a bowl or a platter? So you know before you start. A lot of times beginners and people early in clay start throwing and they change their mind along the way as the clay sort of takes them where it wants to go.
I see. Now, being a professional at it, do you allow yourself that leeway as you're working?
Well, I think there's a lot of experimentation. Potters are taught and encouraged to do a lot of drawing with paper and pencil to really develop their ideas visually on paper before they really take them to the wheel. I do some of that, but probably not as much as I should. So I tend to develop the work and the look I want by throwing the work. And so I'll make a piece, look at it for a little while and say, you know, this would be better if it had, if it were broader in the shoulder or narrower in the neck or whatever the look I'm going for. And so with over time, you, that's where you begin to develop an eye for what it is you want and what you think looks good aesthetically.
And do those changes that occur during the process of making the piece, do they come about as a process of addition or subtraction? Are you removing clay or are you adding clay?
Another good question. For the most part on the wheel, you are you're just moving clay. So you're at the end, you may trim and subtract like a foot rim at the bottom. When the piece is finished, you can turn it over and trim like a nice foot ring to elevate the piece off the table. But for the most part on the wheel, it's you're taking, you know, if you have 4 pounds of clay on the wheel, when you're finished throwing that piece, it should still be about 4 pounds. So it'll be altogether different because you've taken a solid ball of clay and now turned it into walls and form and making a vessel out of it in some way or other.
But that's just the first part of the process, right? I mean, coloring it and putting the glaze on is another whole different deal.
Totally. And that's a very good point. And I get a lot of people come visit my studio and ask if I would throw something on the wheel while they watch. I said, of course. And so I'll make a bowl, maybe 12 inches across or something. They say, oh, that doesn't take very long, does it? And so I said, well, that's step one out of, you know, maybe 50 steps before it's finished. So,
well, you sent me numerous photos of your work. I'm assuming it was mostly yours, although I think there might have been a piece or two by Fumiko in there too. But really gorgeous colors, really gorgeous. Does that come just from the glazes?
Yes, the clay body affects how the glaze will look. So certain clay bodies, it will be rich with iron elements in the clay body, and that will give a lot of patterning and spotted effect in some pieces. So the darker the clay body, usually more iron in there, and the more it'll change the way the glaze looks. So if you have the same glaze and you put it on a dark clay body, let's say a dark brown stoneware versus a white stoneware, the glaze will look quite a bit different.
What is the glaze? What is it made of? What is
It's a lot of silica and properties in there that melt and allow the glaze to become essentially like glass, but it takes on a whole different sort of chemical reaction and interacts with the clay body itself. During the firing, in the glaze firing, they become one, and it's all a chemical process that's not my forte to be really saying exactly all that's going on there. Uh-huh. But it's a fascinating, it's a big part of the fascination with pottery.
Huh. Is it a powder or a liquid? I'm trying to get in my head, like you say, okay, it's time to glaze this pot. What does that mean? How do you do it? What are you doing?
Well, there are a lot of ways to do it, but it's mixed as a powder originally with different chemicals, different clays from the earth, different silica compounds, and so forth. And so as that mixed as dry material, and it's all in very fine form. It's been ground or put through mesh screens and very fine. But then you mix it with water. So I make a 5-gallon bucket of a particular glaze. There's a recipe. It may have 4, 5, 6 ingredients. And I mix those in the bucket and pour again through a sieve to make sure it's smooth and well homogenized. And when the bisque piece that has no glaze on it yet has been fired once, and you apply the liquid glaze right to the piece. You can dunk it, you can spray it, you can brush it on. So all of those have slightly different effects about how the glaze looks upon firing after that application.
And is it just one application of glaze, or do you often apply 2 or 3 or 4?
Usually one. In my case, I like to do just one. It simplifies everything, and it doesn't get too complicated or overworked, in my view. But especially people are spraying a glaze on, you have to do it in a spray booth because of the chemical compounds that are coming out of the sprayer. But it's you can really layer and feather the glaze. It's all the same color glaze, but thicker and thinner as it goes, and that creates some beautiful effects in itself. So usually some people fire will put 2 glazes on, but that you run the risk that the glaze will start to run or the interface between them won't work mechanically. So,
well, some of those pictures, I saw some drips or what look like drips. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't sound like you're against the idea of that kind of thing happening. You allow some spontaneity to occur.
Yeah, that's certainly one of the ways. Some people can really enjoy and learn and actually work to get what we call runs in the glaze, a glaze that runs. But you want it to still be controlled, because if it runs too much, it'll run right off the pot and onto the shelf in the kiln, and that's a big mistake. Okay. So it takes experience and trial and error and a lot of glaze testing to get that effect that you want. And it's a big part of what professional clay artists do, is really work on their glaze palette and decide what look they're wanting, a matte glaze, a shiny glaze, so and everything in between. So
based on the photos you sent me, I'm assuming your glazes are shiny as opposed to matte.
Well, probably mostly, and a lot of the work I've done, I have my own studio, of course, as we talked about, but I do a lot of work up at the Anderson Ranch, and they have beautiful array of glazes and some great choices, and beyond that, they have some wonderful firing opportunities where the wood-fired pots are made there, and so you get an ash glaze. The firing is actually fueled by logs, just like you'd put in your fireplace. And that we heat the kiln with natural wood, dried wood, all the way up to temperature, which is over 2,300 degrees usually.
Wow.
And the burning of the wood creates an ash which moves through the firing and deposits the ash onto the pottery. And that ash has its own chemical makeup that really converts the nature of the glaze into some beautiful effects most of the time.
Huh. How did the ceramics bug bite you, Frank McGurk? How did that start for you?
Well, I'll try to keep it brief, but I was as a young man in college, in the normal age of being in college, I was mainly having fun and not very serious about my major at the time as an undergraduate was psychology, and I just was losing interest and not doing so well with the academics. So I took a year off, and during that year I worked, and I decided I wanted to go back to school, and I said, but I need to take some coursework that will capture my imagination and hold my interest more strongly than chemistry and statistics and classes like that. So that's when I decided to take an art class. And one of the one I applied to get in was ceramics. And so it's like many potter's stories. Once they have tried it for quite a few people, find it irresistible. And that started me down the path.
What makes it irresistible?
Well, I think it's the malleability of the clay and the ability to learn to control a material by practice and learning. There's so much plasticity in good clay bodies that it just feels like a marvel to be able to move that earth, that moist dirt around and form it into some object. And so the more you do it, the more you learn and the more appealing it becomes. I mean, not that you ask, but jumping ahead to this stage of my life, I had a whole number of years in between where I didn't do any clay work because I went into another career. But when I knew I would come back to clay someday. So when I sold my business a number of years ago, I've made that a true thing. And so the last 8 years or so, I've been full-time, almost full-time clay person. And so that's now what I love to do. And it's a blessing for me to have ceramics in my life in many ways. And so that's a big, big part of what I'm doing now.
So what does a typical day look like in your studio? You're there for, you're actually sitting at the wheel for 8 hours?
Oh, no.
6 hours, 4 hours.
No. So, I'm fortunate to have my own studio at my home, so it's easy to walk out to the studio in the morning with a cup of coffee in hand and sort of assess what it is I want to do that day. So, there's usually a lot of different things going on in your studio where some pieces are drying, some pieces are waiting to be made, some pieces are waiting to be glazed and so forth. So it's always different every day, but it is a process that repeats itself. So I would say, I probably don't really spend more than 4 or 5 hours a day in the studio, unless I have a show coming like this one, or I have a commission where someone's ordered a whole set of dishes or whatever, then I really start putting in more time in to get that work done.
How long does it take to make a cup?
Well, we come back to that earlier question, but to actually make it on the wheel, it doesn't take much time at all. You can make a cup in less than 5 minutes, but it still has to have a handle and it still has to be trimmed and then it has to be fired, dried and fired and so on. So I would say cumulative amount of time into a cup might be an hour. I mean, I haven't sat down to do the real business-like analysis, but
and correspondingly upward for plates or really elaborate bowls or sculpture pieces.
Totally, it's exactly right. If you're just cranking out some standard like chili bowls or something, you can turn those out pretty fast.
Huh.
And you could do, I mean, if one really wanted to, you could do 100 in a day. We were talking about my Japanese partner in the show, Fumiko Nagai. She and her mentor, Takashi Nakazato, Takashi, in his early days, I understand it, he could make hundreds of pieces in a day, and that's what he did. That's the life of a potter in Japan, and so he can still do that today, and he's almost 80.
Wow. So, that's impressive.
Yeah.
Huh. Wow, how about that? Let's talk a little bit about Fumiko. She apprenticed herself to Takashi, the gentleman whom you call on your Facebook page sensei.
Yes, of course. That's a Japanese word for teacher. It's a term of honor and respect. Mm-hmm.
I've seen that applied to martial arts, but I've never seen it applied to potters, so that's interesting. But he's not just a regular potter, is he?
Not at all. Although his work has a regular in the sense that he has a tradition that he follows for, I think it's 13 generations of potters in the Nagazato family.
Wow.
And he's the current head of that family and has hundreds of years of family experience in the ceramic life in Japan. And so he continues to work every day. He's one of the most disciplined, hardworking, productive potters, and I've met a lot of potters, but he's probably at the top in terms of just his dedication to his craft and his art.
And so Fumiko did well by apprenticing herself to him.
Yes, and she's been in I don't know exact number of years, but in a few decades ago, apprenticing yourself to a master potter in Japan was akin to they didn't see it this way, I don't think, but it was akin to signing on for a very low wage, high work, no really making pots for sometimes 2 or 3 years. You had to do all the menial work, wedge the clay, haul the clay, clean the studio, and that might take a year or two before you ever were allowed to even sit down at a potter's wheel and make any work. So some of that is not quite that disciplined anymore, but there's still a lot of discipline coming out of the Japanese tradition.
It's hard to imagine falling into a tradition or being an expression of a tradition that runs for 700 years. That just blows my mind. We don't have that in this country, obviously.
Clearly, we don't, yeah. So if I may finish my thought about Fumiko, so she has studied with Takashi as a student, as an assistant, and now the word I've used, I don't know that they use the word, but I say Fumiko's his protege because I know she wants to be seen as her own potter, but she and Takashi still work together often. She has her own studio in Japan. He has his about an hour apart. Mm-hmm. I'm hopeful to go visit there in 2018.
Ooh, nice.
So, yeah. So anyway, that's she's making beautiful work, and it is very much in the tradition of the type of work that Takashi makes. So, but I'd invite everybody who's, our show will be up for the whole month of January, so people really need to come by and see the work. It's a real unique opportunity here in Carbondale to have Japanese pottery in our show. Also, I'd like your listeners to know, Takashi has very generously has donated a very beautiful bowl, a nice larger size bowl that he made that we will sell for the benefit of the Clay Center. So that was an offer he made, and I was ecstatic to get that opportunity to do that. It'll be at the Clay Center, so come buy it.
Wow, how about that? This show, Food, Drink, Flower, curated by Doug Casapier at Anderson Ranch.
Exactly. So Doug and I have become good friends. Doug's been you know, I hadn't thought about this until a few years ago, but I've been relying on Doug for a lot of coaching and asking him, you know, what workshop should I take at the ranch and those kinds of things, and we became more friendly. And I actually, he's come to be my mentor. So even what I'm enthused about is even at this stage of life, I can have a mentor, and I can, Doug has been very, very encouraging in teaching me and working with me. And so this is an opportunity to get him. He's very dedicated to Carbondale Clay Center as well, and serves on our advisory board as an important person who brings a huge amount of experience to us. So Doug is curating the show, and he, of course, he's very close to Takashi and Fumiko and knows them well. And so this is a good opportunity for us to have Doug be part of putting our show together.
From the outside looking in, the Roaring Fork Valley strikes me as a center for ceramics, with Anderson Ranch at one end, Carbondale Clay at the other. Are there other organizations in the valley that are dealing with ceramics?
Well, CMC has a ceramics program in their Aspen campus, and there's in Glenwood Springs, the Arts Center there has a small ceramics teaching space. But, you know, there may be others, but there are a lot of solo practitioner potters in this valley who are just, you know, who are great. Peg Malloy is a good friend of mine. She makes beautiful work, and she lives just outside of Carbondale. And I don't want to leave people off the list, but there are a lot of people here. The Carbondale Clay Center has had for years a residence program. So we bring in 2 to 3 residents a year, young people usually, finishing their bachelor's or master's in fine arts and wanting a year of experience. And so many of those people have stayed on here and add to the richness of our potter community.
It really is a community, isn't it?
Very much so. That's, yeah. And in fact, it's one of the things I love about being in clay. It was a surprise to me when I moved to Carbondale to discover this here. I knew I was going to do clay, but it's turned out that it was just by good fortune on my part that there are just so many good potters here and a lot of people who understand and love ceramics. So it's a blessing to be here.
Well, the other equation of a successful potter is the buyer. Is that right?
Yes.
There must be quite a few educated buyers.
Well, that's a very good question. But, yeah, and we do have. There are a lot of good buyers. And you know, it's nice when you have patrons. And I've slowly developed a following and have people who acquire my work. I don't count myself at the same stage as someone like Doug Casper or others here. But I'm... have made a lot of progress, and so we sell a lot of work up and down the valley, and you know the community as well as anyone, and so what we don't sell work at the price point that they say can sell it at a gallery in Aspen. It's just the nature of the economics near Carbondale and Glenwood. Just you need to make work that has some affordability. Excitement for me is that we make work that gets into homes. We've had sort of we haven't formalized it, but we've been saying a cup in every home or a cup in every hand. And so a goal for the Carbondale Clay Center is to really get the people of Carbondale and the Roaring Fork Valley to become much more appreciative of handmade work in their homes. And so our goal is to get more and more people to be aware of that and to acquire and own and use handmade clay objects. You know, I use them, of course, all the time, and I think it adds a real quality to your life. Even if you aren't the maker, it's a much more comfortable and warming thing to have in your home.
God, your cupboards must be amazing. What's in your
cupboards? Oh, yeah. Well, potters are their own are the best customers for other potters. That's for sure. So I have a lot of beautiful work from all over the country, all over the world now, and yeah. So I think I'm going to buy this piece from so and so. Well, what you need to get rid of one if you want to have that one. So we have a lot. She really appreciates the work, but I'm just saying.
Well, yeah, you know, women are a little more practical about those kinds of things, I think.
Well, but there is a reality to that.
definitely. Yeah. I'm sure. Yeah. Well, you know, you put a lot of your heart and soul into a piece, and it's kind of hard to let it go. Do you find that it's hard to sell your work? I mean, is it hard to let it go?
That's two different questions. it's not so hard to let it go. Occasionally, more and more, I feel like I'm making nicer pieces, and some, you know, once in a while, one will just pop, and you say, "Wow, this I got to keep this just to mark my place in my clay life right now." But for 99% of the time, I'm happy to let it go, and that's a transition I went through. Maybe 3 or 4 years ago, where I would, you kind of learn if you make something and it's just finished, maybe has a little crack or a little something not right, but you could still use it. The temptation early on is to keep it anyway. Well, I've gotten very comfortable just throwing those things away, and I was coached and encouraged to be that way, to be more disciplined, be more particular about what you have and what you keep. So it is. So it's not so hard to let go. Part of it is just the reality of if I make so many pots, they have to go somewhere.
Yeah.
So
yeah. Does a pot have to be perfect?
Well, perfect is in the eyes of the beholder in many ways. I think functionally it has to work. So it has to be very appropriate. If you're having something that's going to touch your lip or be held in your hands as a tea bowl, or you're going to serve food from it. It needs to serve its purpose in a very functional way. So perfect is I think there's sort of, it's like a wine. I would say, somebody may love a Cabernet Sauvignon, and someone else really prefers a Malbec. So they can both be perfect, I guess, but they're different. So I think that's kind of that analogy may not be the greatest, but anyway, I think a lot of altering of forms and movement. You make what might be a perfect sphere, and then you start pushing it around and moving the clay again to change the shape and change the look and create a new dynamic with it. So some may look at that and say, "Well, that doesn't look so perfect anymore." Others see the beauty and the change. So,
With any handmade object, whatever it is, there will be inevitably, I would think, imperfections that aren't necessarily unattractive that you want to keep.
That happens a lot, and especially, yes, and I think it can be those sort of lucky mistakes, if you will, can be beautiful, and sometimes it happens with the glaze. And, most often it will happen with the glaze, not in the actual throwing. I mean, you'll see it early. I mean, you may get something coming off of your work, and you say, "Oh, what if I try this or push this over here?" And you say, "Wow, that's good. I'm going with that." But the glazing then really gets sometimes these lucky outcomes. And like I was saying, at the ranch and anywhere that you're using wood firing or soda firing to finish the piece, the beauty of those firings is you get all these effects that are, you sort of know they're coming, but you just don't know how they're going to manifest themselves. So you can get just some beautiful work that comes out of that.
Wow. And surprising. And it's kind of cool to be doing something with so much invested in it and to have a surprise that you just go, "I love it. That's great."
And that happens. The potters are usually, I think, once you have been doing it, again, as long as I have, there's a lot of times early on when it first comes out of the firing, you need a little time to see if you like. Some of you can say, "Wow, this is something." But a lot of good ones, you're saying, "I'm not sure." And then you live with it even a day or two or a week, and it's like, "Wow, this is a better piece than I thought." So it it's a lot of subtlety in there, in the form and the shape and how that piece speaks to you. It kind of grows and not always right there, right now. So that's part of the mystery and excitement of making pottery.
Interesting. I love that. This may be a dumb question, but is there anything new to discover in the field of ceramics? Has it all been discovered already? Are y'all reinventing the wheel?
I smile, but because it's not a dumb question, it is a terrific question. Often you think everything under the sun in pottery has been done, but some designs, a lot of the young people getting their masters in fine arts and whatnot really reach, in my view, they reach in pretty hard and kind of contrived sometimes to try to make work that has a look and a feel and a and sort of stimulation value that hasn't been traditional. So there's an effort, I think, mainly with younger folks to try to move beyond tradition and move into this avant-garde. And some of that can, I think, doesn't have much staying power, but let me stop there. So the on that part, but there is, you know, with the advent of like soft brick and all kinds of parts of the technology of clay being modern, it's sometimes easier to get more pure chemicals or a kiln that's fired more predictably. And so that's changing and getting better. But for the most part, a lot of the stuff, you can look at pots that are 500 or 1,000 years old, and they look more beautiful and more perfect and more glaze dynamics than we can get today. I mean, it can be done, but it's a real cultural and cross-cultural thing.
Well, not to mention future archaeologists discovering pottery shards from 2000s Carbondale. Someday they'll find a piece and they'll go, that's Carbondale, 2016.
Yeah, maybe my name will be on the bottom.
Do you sign your pieces?
I do, and since I've been working with my Japanese friends and mentors, I came up with a little. Most of them use a symbol that indicates that's their piece, and so I've came up with my own sort of FM. I sort of modified that to make a mark. I asked Fumiko, I said, does this mean anything in Japanese? I wanted to make sure I wasn't saying some bad word or something my symbol. But so I use that a lot on smaller pieces. The bigger ones I put my last name on.
So do you carve that or do you stamp it? Or you?
I do it by hand. I just with a sharp-edged stick.
Sure. Interesting. Even the functional pieces, the somewhat prosaic pieces, you still sign those?
Yes, and partly because people say, they comment when they buy your piece, they say, oh, good, I'm glad your name's on here. If I have a piece that I forgot to sign or didn't sign, they'll say, oh, I want one that you've signed. So there is this sort of value on the signature as you know, obviously potters aren't commanding the painter's prices, but you wouldn't want to buy a painting from some well-known painter unless they had original signature on there. So I think that spills over to where people expect to see an artist's signature on the work.
Sure. What's next for Frank McGurk after this show?
Oh, well, I'm happy to be, I have, you know, the Carbondale Arts has their upcoming Valley Visual show, and they picked 50 people, one piece each, so I have a piece in that, and but that's already made and ready to go. So after this, I've got some commissions and work I want to do. This summer, I'll definitely be back at the Anderson Ranch. I usually try to go for at least 3 weeks a year, and just because of its convenience, I'm back and forth often to hear speakers or see now old friends who I've met from there before. I'll do some personal traveling in the spring. And so just continuing to work and keep developing my clay life. And so that's pretty straightforward. I'm kind of a simple person now.
Congratulations. How did you do that?
Well,
you have to tell me your secret.
Yeah, well, it's maybe another day.
Okay. Yeah, you could write a bestseller.
Yeah.
Then, Frank McGurk, I want to thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you so much. And if I may say at the end of our talk is that I want to point out that this is the 20th anniversary of the Carbondale Clay Center beginning.
20 years.
Yeah, the 20th anniversary. Wow. And we have a great board. We've added some new board members, and we have really a lot of good things going on at the Clay Center. So we really appreciate the support of our community here for that, and we intend to keep doing more and better things.
That's remarkable, Frank, because I know there were several periods in that 20 years where you probably thought maybe it wasn't going to last.
Well, I haven't been as long around for the whole 20 years, maybe 8 years more or less on and off involved with the Clay Center, much more so in the last couple of years. But I used to say it's always hanging on by its fingernails. It's like a lot of small nonprofits, but now we've got a more continuity. We have our asset base is stronger. We have more predictable revenue stream. We still are not rich by any means, but sure. We're still working hard every month to keep everything going, but we're feeling good about where the Clay Center is.
Well, it's pretty incredible little asset for the Carbondale art community, and I'm really glad that you're anchoring the east end of Main Street there for us.
Well, thanks, Gus. Glad to be neighbors almost.
Yeah. Thank you, Frank.
Thank you so much, Luke. I'm really happy to have been here and had this conversation.
Likewise.